does some particular function that you don't want. And now you need selectivity. Let me drop. So Ma Bell discovered this, designed this touch tone system where each individual button presses and creates not one tone, but two individual tones. The reason for that is music in the background is not going to create a false alarm, because the probability of the music in the background, for instance, creating those exact combination of tones on those exact frequencies with those exact amplitude ratio, the probability of that happening is very, very low. Therefore, there's almost no false alarm when you've got two tones. With one tone, you'd be getting a false alarm every single day. With two tones, you're going to get a false alarm once every 5 years, so to speak. You study the probability ratio of carefully selected tones of the right amplitude ratio and the right frequency ratio and the right accuracies of those frequencies, you're going to get very little false alarms. When you dig deeper into those two tones, you're going to find there's some other very fancy sophistication going on. Let me drop. A naive person designing those two tones might decide that, okay, I want one of the tones to be 800 hertz and I want the other tone to be 1600 hertz, a 2-to-1 ratio. Very bad choice. Because as that 800 hertz tone goes down the audio system of a long distance call, because some one of those repeater stations somewhere along the line has a significant amount of second harmonic generation. Therefore, the 800 hertz that you're plugging in there is simultaneously going to be generating the second harmonic of 1600 hertz. And if you chose those two tones, it's a very bad choice. You study those two tones, you'll discover that each of those pairs of frequencies are very, very well chosen to be essentially unrelated to each other from a double point of view. First of all, one is not an easy harmonic of the other. There may be a ratio of frequencies that are 1.375 different from each other. Second of all, they've also recognized not only are they not harmonically related, they are also not intermodulation distortion related. When you have more than one tone going into any kind of a system, like when you want to test the linearity of your single sideband transmitter at high power output, the main thing you do is a two-tone test. Let me drop. Those two tones that you're plugging into the microphone circuit, so to speak, of a single sideband transmitter, and you might choose two tones of 1 kc and 1.5 kc. You don't worry in the case of a two-tone test to worry about the harmonic relationship much of the time, but you're transmitting two simultaneous audio tones into the system, and if you carefully adjust the amplitude of the two tones so that they're equal to each other, for periods of time, for microseconds at a time, those two tones are in phase, but because one's at a higher frequency than the other, and therefore at an angular rate, it's moving faster than the other one, a few microseconds later, it's going to be exactly 180 degrees out of phase of those two tones. As such, your whole transmitter is going to full power output during the time the two tones are in phase with each other, to absolute zero power output when the two tones are out of phase with each other. And if the two tones in my example are separated by 500 hertz, 1 over 500 hertz is 2 microseconds, if I've got it right, 2 milliseconds. So once every 2 milliseconds, the system goes from full power output to absolute zero power output and then repeats. So that's a very specific amplitude versus time signal characteristic that you're injecting. And if the transmitter has perfect linearity, during the peak of power output, every 2 milliseconds, there will be no flat topping. During every valley of power output, there will be no crossover distortion when it goes through zero. So you get this very characteristic butterfly pattern on an oscilloscope when you're doing a two-tone test. And if you plug the output of that transmitter into a very well-calibrated spectrum analyzer, let me drop it. With that spectrum analyzer, you're now able to, in a calibrated manner, measure the peak envelope power, the amount of power of each one of those RF tones after they've been through your single sideband transmitter, where the audio has now been transmitted into a radio signal, and by way of the spectrum analyzer, you'll now be able to see the other signals that are being generated alongside of those two tones on that screen. If the perfect. On the screen, you're going to see two vertical spikes, in my example, 500 hertz apart. But these are RF frequencies. It might be at 144.0 and 144.001, if I got it correctly. But you know what I mean. 005 megahertz apart, 500 hertz apart, those two tones. And if this transmitter has perfect linearity, you'll see no flat topping. You'll see no other tones. However, whatever the separation between those two tones is, if there's the smallest amount of third, fifth, seventh order intermodulation distortion, you'll see other signals on that screen. And if the transmitter is meeting FCC and usual gentlemen's agreement performance, all of those tones should be, all of those undesired tones should be suppressed by 35 or so decibels, weaker, in which case you're not going to be significantly jamming the adjacent channel of other guys on the 20 meter band, so to speak. Let me drop. So as you can slowly see, there's a whole art and science to putting two tones into a transmitter where you're measuring linearity, to putting two carefully chosen tones that are not harmonically related to each other when you're using those tones for control functions on an audio circuit. When they read the appropriate copy of the Bell System Technical Journal, and most good libraries have now taken functions, keep their identity unknown, they would make a phone call between anybody trying to trace that call had a great difficulty.
A dipole for 80 meters, a dipole for 40 meters, a dipole for
five dipoles all come to a common point in the center. They're all separated by maybe 5 degrees from each other. They're fanned out at the tips. And so you've got individual egg insulators at the tips, and there's various ways you can join them together to one lanyard line that supports it to your nearest tree, or they can go to individual lines to various altitudes on the tree. There's a lot of different ways you can mechanically arrange that. But the magic of resonance, and if you've ever listened to one of my lectures on how a antenna, dipole-like antenna, really operates, you'll discover that there's a huge amount of science that takes place at the atomic level inside of that antenna when it hits resonance. That 80-meter dipole, for instance, you made it on a 14-gauge wire. It's 132 feet long, split in the middle with an egg insulator in the middle, and you're feeding it with, we'll say, 50-ohm or 70-ohm coax with a balancing device in the center. And so that wire itself, that 132-foot-long piece of wire, and the 14-gauge wire is something in the vicinity of a 16th of an inch in diameter. It casts a shadow on the ground of roughly 1 square foot at high noon. If the sun was a point source, you wouldn't be able to see that shadow. In reality, there's a bunch of reasons why you can't see it. Anyhow, that's the real shadow. That's the real physical area of that wire. When that wire is resonant at 3.7 megahertz, the middle of the 80-meter ham band. Let me drop it. And now you can either measure the gain of that antenna when it transmits, and you can calculate that into a transmitting area, or you can measure the amount of signal it receives, and you can calculate into that effective capture area of reception. You'll discover that that dipole, with 1 square meter of effective area physically, has a radio effective area, both on transmit and receive, identical, because the law of reciprocity, 8,500. Eyes raised at 3.7 megs, and you stood a quarter of a mile away, and you looked at that antenna broadside, 150 feet wide, and be about 60 feet high. That big black oval in space, all the signal that's horizontally polarized at 3.7 megacycles, that hits that antenna broadside, all of it inside of that black oval gets absorbed, all of it ends up on that piece of wire. All of it, per se, goes down that transmission line, goes into your receiver, and moves that S-meter. Its real effective area, because of resonance, is huge. 8,500-to-1 ratio in that example. And I'm not kidding. You should be very doubtful when you hear this stuff because it sounds crazy. But these words are traceable to the bureau, so to speak. Let me drop. As such, when that antenna is resonant, it does that. Both on transmit and receive. You now take the exact same amplitude of signal on 40 meters, 7.2 megahertz instead of 3.7 megahertz. And now you'll discover that the effective area of transmit and the effective area of receiving, which used to be 8,500 square feet, has just gone down to a couple of square feet because it is no longer properly resonated with the method of feeding it. So, when you build a fan dipole, that 80-meter dipole is presenting a 73-ohm impedance when a signal at 3.7 megacycles hits it, in my example. You put a 40-meter signal, 7.2 megacycles, into that antenna. That antenna, instead of having a 72-ohm impedance, it's got a 1,500 to 2,000-ohm impedance. Very little of the signal on that 50-ohm transmitter, transmission line, is going to go down the 2,000-ohm antenna. It looks like an open circuit. It's almost not there. As such, when you build a fan dipole, the presence of the individual resonances of the individual dipoles that all come to that common point in the center, let me drop it, that becomes an automatic switching function. You don't even have to put the relay there to do it. Electronically, you've done it. You could really say this is a five-port bandpass filter, five individual filters. The resonance phenomena of each individual antenna, even though it's a radial piece of 14-gauge wire that didn't cost you very much, it is a bandpass filter. That signal will go down the right antenna at the right time, and it will ignore essentially all the others. You could, if you want to, as a science experiment, put a neon bulb circuit across the 80-meter dipole, across the 40-meter dipole, and so on. And you would discover that as you put the 80-meter signal or the 40-meter signal into that fan dipole system, the radio signal will automatically go down the right dipole, because that's the only one that gives the 72 ohm impedance. All the others are approximately an open circuit at that time, and no energy goes there. So you'll be lighting up the right neon bulb, depending on what band you're on. You could put five neon bulbs on your fan dipole, stand outside the house, and somebody inside the house is operating the transmitter on one of the five bands. You'd know immediately which band he's on because of which light bulb that lights up. But you don't even have to put the light bulbs there. This is another one of those cases where you can make a leap of faith. Once you understand the theory of operation, take my word for it, that signal will go into the right dipole at the right time for that frequency automatically. It won't go to the other ones. Go ahead and confirm it. It's an interesting science experiment. But it's really like dropping the brick to find out does gravity pull on each one of these bricks, if you know what I mean. You're doing an experiment that you don't really have to do once you understand the physics involved. So that fan dipole, as you can tell, let me drop. That fan dipole gives you a lot of bang for the dollar. It covers a whole lot of bands all at once. Extremely good standing wave ratio on all those bands all at once. And if you mount it high enough in the air, it gives you darn good predictable performance on all of those bands. Depending on how many wavelengths the ARRL antenna book, or even maybe the right chapter of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, and predict what is the takeoff angle. Because when you make a horizontally polarized dipole above Earth, that Earth really is a kind of a mirror. There's a real dipole above the ground, there's a mirror image of one below the ground, and because of the way the ground gives you 180-degree phase reflection, the dipole below the ground, the virtual dipole, is 180 degrees out of phase. Therefore, by definition, there's almost always a null on the horizon for your elevation pattern. And at some number of degrees above the horizon is where those two dipoles come back in phase with each other. And so at a reasonable altitude, your dipole is going to give you a takeoff angle of, say, 25 or 30 degrees. And now that 25-degree elevation angle, the peak of it, goes out to X number of miles, hits the ionosphere, bounces off the ionosphere at that 30-degree angle, and then goes forward for the rest of the communication range that you're talking to. So altitude above the ground is the primary determining factor of what is your elevation takeoff angle. And then elevation above the ground is in wavelengths for that particular frequency. And it's really a geometry problem, if you know what I mean. So takeoff angle, where the signal goes, which dipole it chooses to go down, and there's multiple ways of building this thing mechanically so that it becomes, it'll survive the wind and ultraviolet and rain and ice loading and everything else. Let me drop. And there's zillions of different ways that you can mechanically support it to make it more robust, to electronically tune it and so on. But it is a very low, what's the word for it now? Relatively low technology, very high performance antenna, which is very inexpensive. And so, if you're getting on HF for the first time, and if somebody wants to compare the economics of building a fan dipole versus going out there and spending $300, $400, $600 to buy a multi-band, ground plane, shiny-looking, super whammo antenna, you can go out there and buy many hundreds of dollars worth of ground plane antenna from some very good manufacturers, and you compare the performance to this $30 fan dipole, boy, what a comparison there is. In many cases, the dipole will be higher in performance, and it's only 1/10 or 1/50 of the cost. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Good information, Dick. Yeah, I'm sure you could have a lot of fun with that, keying up this mic and seeing which antenna is lighting up. But, you know, it's similar to the peg test, you know, the board peg. When those signals are going up there, it's a round peg, it's only going to fit in a round hole. Square peg is going to go in a square hole. And that's basically what's happening. So, a lot of fun. By the way, now, I have one that may take a while. This has to do with a VNA and a tuner. Would you rather have full the space report? We can save this for next week. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, Dick. Go right ahead, Eric.
Listen to 375 then.
Okay, I'm submitting on this repeat. Oh, 375 sounds beautiful. Oh, whatever you did, do more of it. Fantastic. Over to you, Eric, KQRIW.
Eric, I also got notes. EchoLink audio has improved.
Really like what I really gonna do one of these days. I mean, I have a file of a sweep generator. But bring my tracking sweep generator and see what this thing actually looks like. But this should be better.
Now, better is an understatement. That is hi-fi audio. It's about time. Why did we have to wait so long? My guess is you had to do quite a bit of change in that radio link between east and west. Is that true, Eric? In other words, I suspect this is a fairly heroic effort when you look at the great big picture. KE2EJ, tell us anything about this.
K2IW, KE2EJ. What I find really amazing is I'm here in Selden. I'm in on the ground floor inside the building, and I can hear the link transmitted from Glen Oaks on my little HT, which is really funny.
Well, you just happen to be at Adirondack Drive. Your feet are sitting 330 feet above sea level. You've got almost direct line of sight to Glen Oaks. Your handy talkie, lucky for you, has got enough dynamic range that it's not being jammed by all the strong local signals. An awful lot of the world is going over the fiber instead of RF, so the number of signals you've got there locally has decreased in the last few years. So the fact that your good handy is listening to that signal from Glen Oaks is a very good sign, and it's kind of predictable from my point of view, Eric. KE2EJ, K2IW. Question for Eric.
Yeah, okay. Well, the funny thing is, I cranked down Glen Oaks, I measured the output. It's putting out, before it gets to the antenna, it's putting out about 3.5 watts. What I did was I kept lowering the power until I heard noise and then gave myself like a 10% boost. I mean, I can make 100 watts, but I don't need it.
Okay, you're talking about the RF link, I believe. I can't believe that you turned Glen Oaks down to 3 watts. We have a lot of people complaining that 146.85, I don't hear it anymore. So you're talking about the RF link. And by the way, the RF link, is it on the same band it used to be on, or is it on a brand new band, Eric? Because I'm not hearing any clicks in the background. KE2EJ, K2IW, and then pass it over to John.
A completely different band, believe me. And the portion of the band that I'm in is very, very quiet. I'll just leave you to guess until I talk to you in person.
Well done. And boy, you got hi-fi audio all of a sudden. It's about time. But I presume it took a considerable investment of equipment to get transmitters and receivers on both ends on this new band. Is that true, Eric?
No, it took equipment, but it just so happens that we've been collecting the equipment, so finally I got the stuff in the segment that I needed. But yeah, if we collect junk, what can I tell you?
I keep collecting junk. Unfortunately, though, that makes you and I radio hoarders. And so, if somebody offers me a brand new piece of test equipment, I've got to sit and think, okay, where am I going to put that? All my usual radio storage places are saturated. KT2WGB, K2LGB, go ahead, John.
Yes, just a question for Eric. I've gotten reports that EchoLink keeps timing out 4 or 5 times in the past few minutes. Is there a reason for that? Is it something we're concerned with or something you know about?
I'll bet you he was doing service. Go ahead, Eric.
Are you saying that EchoLink times out?
I'm sorry, IRLP.
IRLP has a definite limit that's hardwired into it. And I deliberately kill it before it gets to its limit.
Comment?
Okay, good enough.
I heard comment. We'll pick you up in a second. Eric, when IRLP times out, is there something the listener can do to turn it back on, or does it reset itself automatically? Over to you, Eric.
Well, there's a couple of different scenarios. One is if people pick it up and they don't wait for the beep. It might actually reset my timer, but the time in the ILP doesn't necessarily reach that. That's why the beeps are as long as they are. Well, they're really long for echolink, not for ILP, but it needs a certain amount of time. ILP will actually disconnect the other listeners if it goes over 4 minutes.
It's not as getting disconnected. What was that again?
Tonight in Toronto, we've been disconnected several times because of timeout. It just drops the link, no announcement from the node for disconnect, and it's hard to keep connected to the net. I don't know how many people are listening. I'm Jim, the E3JIW.
WN2
WRY,
can I make a comment on this?
Yeah, thank you for that information, Jim. Joe, wait for the four beeps, which I didn't do, and go right ahead, Joe.
You're going to have to lengthen the beep some more because I've told you this before and you just don't want to listen to it in reality. If you don't, people jump on the thing and even miss the beep once before you're supposed to talk, it will become additive and it will make that 4 minute mark happen very, very quickly. Probably one way of doing it is to lengthen the courtesy tone beeps and have people try to obey it, especially during TechNet, and that will probably stop this nonsense from happening.
Let's see what Eric has got to say on all of the above. KE2EJ, KQRIW, please address that subject. And after that, let me also mention that my favorite input frequency right now is not working, and you probably know about that. Over to you, Eric.
Another 10 seconds. I got my hands in here.
Let's hope his hands are not into the high voltage. We're going to stand by and wait until Eric comes back.
Hey, Joe.
I heard HO. We'll pick up with you in a second.
Dick.
And I also heard somebody say, Dick. Let's pick up with John. KC2SHO. Go ahead, John, from Laurel, I think it is, K2LAW.
Settings here just to be sure, but I believe the default IRLP timer, this is when you set up an IRLP node, I believe the default timer is 3 minutes. It might be a little more than that. I'm about to go into the file and look here, but don't forget that a lot of the repeaters these are connected to also have the 3 minute timer. So it's a multi-part problem. One, if you time out IRLP and nobody's there to reconnect it, in other words, all listeners don't always have the means or the knowledge or the permission to work with an IRLP node. So when you drop those nodes, it's unfortunate. Sometimes they just never come back. But like the previous comments, how do you really fix that? A lot of fast keying, a lot of people trying to get their word in edgewise. KC2SHO.
Very fine, John. Eric, are you back with us, or you still got your hands deep into the equipment? Be careful what you touch.
Yeah, I'm back. So, do you have a question?
So, let me sit down. A previous Joe was telling us about the difficulty of proper timing and the additive function of IRLP. If somebody picks up too soon, and he's recommending that we make the beeps longer so that when people do listen to the four beeps, everything comes out right. Now, that's one subject, and the other subject is that my favorite input frequency is now K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. First of all, your favorite input frequency is kind of deaf. The antenna that it's connected to is open. Or so it seems, or at least my VNA says it is. And I've got another antenna which I'm using for this thing, which I was using for something else, 450 band. Got a base wire of over 5. That's some antenna problem to take care of. And as far as the timing of ILP goes, beeps to actually, the station to beep, every time I make them longer, people start complaining. But actually, it's just enough if you let the beeps go. And a lot of times people just talk, like, you know, you're finished, oh, I'll start talking. not enough for the IRLP.
Yeah, when it comes to cables disconnecting themselves from antennas, I've had that problem happen to me a couple of weeks ago, and I'm going to have to climb the tower and do some fixing. And I can see how you've run into it, too. Also, when it comes to my favorite input frequency, you did have in the past one or two other alternatives. If I wanted to, I don't need it now, could they be enabled in order before that antenna gets fixed, one of the other alternates? Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Something that I was going to try that I forgot when I left Red Oak, so I'm going to put my antenna on that receiver and see if it can hear you. If I did, I would have been blessed if I forgot about it. Now I got to get hold of the people who own the building, get the antenna down for me. Once that gets straightened out, then that'll all change. And actually, I am going to move you anyway, different place. And if you need to go to the alternates, you know, you've got this, and you shut those off. We've got the ones upstairs, so you can reach those too.
Understand. In the case of the IRLP setup, which gets linked to other repeaters in other countries, states, and whatever, it's something that does get used a lot during the TechNet, to my knowledge. Is there a way that we could set up the beeper timing and something else I'm going to mention in a minute, not on this transmission, next transmission. Can we set up the IRLP to be different during the TechNet than the rest of the week, so to speak? I have the impression that IRLP is not used as much during the rest of the week. Am I wrong on that one, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
When people are talking on IRLP, it happens quite often. There's a certain etiquette. I'll give you an example. If you dial up, say, the Western Reflector, the announcement will say to wait 2 seconds before speaking, so that way the system can come up and it doesn't cut off the first two or three letters you call for. It tells you that there's a little bit of delay going on there. And it's really not delay, it's the control circuits coming into play. In terms of, I can make the beep longer, but will people adhere to it? I could make the TechNet beep a lot longer. And it's really a matter of practice, because there are nets on IRLP, and they're strictly IRLP nets, and the people who use it are aware of it, and they know what their boundaries are. So, what can I tell you?
I've got a suggestion, which is going to sound kind of severe, and I'm going to buy you. Could set up IRLP in such a way during the TechNet that when a person drops a transmission because he's about to pass it over to somebody else, and let's say that true 4 seconds of delay is required, that once more than a half second of delay takes place, which means it's not just a picket fence, that the machine automatically locks out anything coming through for the next 4 seconds, whether the guy is talking or not. It's severe. But if we did that, during the TechNet, could we force the system to never drop IRLP? Yeah, people would have to get used to it. They'll eventually discover that the first 3 seconds of their quick response audio is not going to be there. But is that a possible solution, or is that out of the question? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, if I had designed the controller that we're using, you know, I'd have written the software in such a way that I could actually, you know, close the port for the minimum time it needs to be closed. Understand something. The way that the controller works, okay, when you're listening to 8.5, there's a squelch tail on it. There's actually an anti-kachunk, which a lot of people lose the first three letters of a call sign, but you've got to squeeze the mic for, I think, a second, 1.75 seconds before the machine will even come up. That, you call that channel one. Now, there's a long tail on that. That's what people hear when they're listening to 8.5. As far as the links are concerned, you have link to here, Sheldon, or IRLP, or Echo Link. As soon as the carrier drops, it drops. The problem is, you know, even though the repeater might be in the not passing audio mode, okay, the other link stuff doesn't have the tail, doesn't have the other things on it. So if somebody just keys up, it goes through. Controller, I wouldn't let that happen.
Okay, sounds like some further improvements might take place in the future. But anybody coming through IRLP, I notice quite often, I will hear the suffix of their call letters, but the prefix is all gone because they started talking immediately. Each person coming through IRLP, and let me drop and try something right now. Hello. Yeah, I noticed that even on mine, there's a little bit of delay by the time I start transmitting until my audio starts coming through. So we have to train everybody to either say the call letters twice, or like you say, squeeze and wait a full second and a half before you start talking. Other than that, the beginning of your conversation won't be there. Any further comments, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Yeah, well, you know, it's operating etiquette is really what it is. Well, it's actually what we call in the video is the operator error.
Yep, pilot error, operator error. John, vector network analyzers is something that I used to hate intensely because they were so cumbersome, so slow, and whatever. But after the last 10 years of using them for developing what I think are some very sophisticated antennas, patented antennas, with performance that exceeds what Mr. Bodie Fano thinks was possible, what Mr. Chu Wheeler thought was possible. I've built some antennas that seem to exceed the previous rules of thumb. And as such, all of that was done on a vector network analyzer. And all of a sudden, I realized that a modern-day, well-tuned vector network analyzer with its internal computer program, which is a 12-point correction program, they are so valuable that if you get your hands on one at any reasonable price, go for it. That's why I'm telling you on this one, you've got an opportunity for it. Even if it's got a blown cathode ray tube and a bad high-voltage power supply, and it's got a dent in the front panel that's been thrown down a flight of stairs, at your level of affluence, John, buy it. KC2WGB, let's have that VNA question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
You know, I carry one with my computer and my laptop bag.
What was that again, Eric?
At this very second, have a VNA in my laptop bag. And I use it, I've never seen myself use it so much. I use it for so many things.
Okay, so you've got this vector network analyzer in your laptop bag. Right now, I know where you're located. If I had a weapon, I'd go there and try to remove it from you, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
He's just spoiled, Dick.
I put it up against the Rosen Schwartz and it's damn close. It's darn good. It's called a mini VNA. It actually has a battery in it if you want to hang it onto an antenna and by Bluetooth, your computer will pick it up.
That's a machine. And by the way, that Rosen Schwartz vector network analyzer, I'm talking about a Rode that's 1999 vintage, I think it was, 2000 vintage, not the latest and greatest. My goodness, is that a machine. I think I've told you guys a couple of times. I can calibrate it on Tuesday morning in February, leave it on all day, every day, turn it off every night, turn it back on every morning, and in December, 10 months later, I check the calibration, and it's right on. Wow. Whereas the Hewlett-Packard makes a fine vector network analyzer, but you might have to recalibrate it every 2 hours, because if it gets a sudden glitch in the power supply, it loses a portion of its calibration. Whatever Rode did, man, that is a machine. Over to you, Eric. And so I think you're saying yours is like the Rode, or maybe even it's a fallout of the Rode design. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Designed by a guy in Germany. It looks like two little bud boxes smashed into plastic cases. Pretty sophisticated. It goes from, it goes from like 100 kilohertz, I think, to 1.2 gigs. It's real cool.
And you can carry that to the top of the tower, run tests right there to select whether or not the transmission line or the antenna is giving you the grief. And the data can be by Bluetooth transmitted back down to the ground in live time, in real time. That's a machine. If anybody hearing my voice that hasn't become familiar with Victor Network Analyzer. What in the world is it? It's a frequency synthesized, amplitude controlled, very accurate, high spectral purity signal generator. That's a fancy way of saying it's got a damn good signal generator. It's also got a damn good sampling kind of receiver where it has extremely good sensitivity as a receiver. So it usually has at least two ports on most of them, the so-called J1 port and J2 port in the front panel. In some situations, it transmits the signal out of the J1 port, goes to your device under test, and receives the signal out of the J2 port, and sweeps across your selected set of frequencies. I usually was setting the thing up to sweep from 850 to 1,000 megahertz when I'm testing a signal going through a 915 megahertz antenna that I was building on the bench. I wanted the antenna to have very high performance from 902 to 928 megahertz. That's the so-called license-free band in that frequency region. And I'd like to look a little bit beyond, a little bit lower and a little bit higher. Let me drop this. Because the outer band response of the antenna is also telling me a valuable piece of information. How fast is it rolling off? Does it re-enter? And so by looking at the characteristic curve of re-entrance frequencies on the outer band frequencies, on the I get a hint as to what's going on with the tuning procedure that I'm doing in real time. And so the Victor Network Analyzer sweeps through every one megacycle region approximately from 850 to 1,000. And it does each one of those sweeps, stopping at every 1 megahertz, 30 times per second, and displaying that on the screen in real time. And it's simultaneously displaying amplitude and phase angle, or simultaneously displaying gain and standing wave ratio, is the way I was using it when I was testing antennas. So I was doing a two-port test, and so the amount of signal that flowed from my antenna under test to another receiving antenna 3 feet away, that became the gain curve. And the signal that went into the antenna and reflected back to that J1 port, that was the standing wave ratio display. So I would display the blue curve for gain, the yellow curve for standing wave ratio on the exact same XY plot, 850 to 1,000 megacycles. I think is the way I often said it. What was it, 950? Yeah, I think it was 850 to 1,000 megs. And so that characteristic XY plot with the simultaneous blue and yellow curve, 30 sweeps per second on that screen, which means that to a human eye, there is no flicker. Everything you see on that screen is real time. So as you wave your tuning tool, let me drop it. As you wave your tuning tool, your finger, or whatever, near the antenna, you immediately see, did the gain go up or down? Did the standing wave ratio go up and down? Did they go up and down together or in opposite directions? Move to another location? Can you make both get better simultaneously and so on? I could design, could say, 50 antennas per day. 50 antennas. I'm designing a three-element Yagi made out of a copper foil on a piece of, on a sheet of mylar. And you could say that sometimes I'm making the director longer or shorter or fatter or curved. I'm making the driven element longer, shorter, fatter, or curved. And the same thing with the reflector. By way of all of those variations that I'm seeing in real time, as I take a piece of copper tape on the end of a long wooden stick and wave it near the center of the element, near the tip of the element, bridging the gap between the elements and so on, you could say that I'm testing 100 or 50 variations of the antenna within a six-hour day by looking at their real-time display. If I tried to do that with computer-aided design, computer modeling programs, each time I change the width, the length, the thickness, the curve, or whatever of an element, and put all of that raw data into a computer modeling program and wait for it to grind an hour or two to give me an answer, and the answer is not very accurate. Let me drop it. By way of computer-aided design, computer modeling, I could probably test 2 antennas per day. I can test 50 antenna variations per 6-hour day with this procedure, and it allowed me to find things I never would have found any other way, because serendipity kept striking. Every so often I would hold that piece of copper tape midway between two elements, which means I'm coupling, I'm increasing or decreasing the coupling coefficient depending on phase angle between the elements, which is electronically doing the equivalent of changing the spacing between the two elements as well as the individual tunings. And I'm watching this simultaneous display. Under most circumstances, when you do something to increase the gain of a three-element Yagi, the standing wave ratio goes out the window. Or you correct the standing wave ratio and you lose some of the gain. They tend to be, they tend to fight each other. They're adverse adjustments. But on certain ways of holding the piece of tuning tool tape and eventually taping it down to the Mylar, there are certain key positions where both get better simultaneously. And you look at the display and, aha, whatever the hell that was, I'm going to do more of it because it's getting better and better simultaneously. There's a few rare ways where you can do that. You would never have found that. You wouldn't live long enough to do it by computer modeling. But with a good vector network analyzer displaying all that data simultaneously to a smart guy who is a computer, who is a ham radio type tinkerer, boy, can you do magic. And that's how I put my name on 30 antenna patents that resulted from those kind of experiments. And 27 of those patents have been granted so far, and 6 of them are in production. So am I that much of an antenna genius? Not necessarily. I just happened to find a way of using a modern piece of... Let me drop this. I happened to find a way of using a modern piece of test equipment in a very crafty way. I've never read an article telling people how to do this. All of the courses we take will teach you that computer-aided modeling is the be-all, end-all. And almost all the antenna and companies out there these days will say, they brag about the fact, I modeled it first and then I built it. They're bragging about the fact they don't do any tinkering, that they don't do any laboratory experiments to come up with their antenna design. They think that that's a good brag. Based on the way the courses are taught in our schools, that is the philosophy, the religion that an awful lot of people have. And I'm preaching an entirely opposite religion, if you know what I mean. Maybe it's an atheistic religion, but still, it works. And I'm finding antennas that exceed the usual rules of thumb of achievable performance in antennas. And so I can design an antenna with a three-element Yagi on 902 to 928 megacycles, where across that frequency region, it has 6.0 or more dB of gain over isotropic, and the standing wave ratio never exceeds 1.0621 across 26 megahertz. Put that as a requirement on a request for bid for an antenna, and you send that to all the antenna manufacturers anywhere in the world. 98% of them will no bid, and 50% of them, so to speak, will not even give you a response. They think you're crazy. I was building those antennas that everyone thinks is impossible. And at first you'd say, well, something funny is going on with the vector network analyzer. It's not real. Well, you can try two or three different vector network analyzers, two or three different brand names, and you get the exact same performance. And then you connect it to the front end of a radio frequency identification reader or interrogator, and you...
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, I hope the system reset. Looks like everything did, as far as east and west is concerned. You connect that to the front end of a RFID reader, and you get 22 or 24 feet of range on a thoroughly passive RFID tag, and you say, wow, something's working. An RFID reader, by the way, is a CW radar. It transmits a key-down CW signal to the tag after it's done its identification function. At first, starts off sending a coded signal saying that all the tags beginning with this serial number talk to me now, or all tags talk to me now. The system first sends out that coded signal. Then it transmits a key down steady signal that powers the tag, and the tag then spits back its 98-bit code to you. 96-bit, 98-bit, I'm not sure. And so you're transmitting and receiving on the exact same frequency simultaneously. No offset. There's no 600 kc of offset. If at this instant of time the reader is transmitting 915.00 megahertz, it is receiving at 915.00 megahertz. And your first question is, how in the world do you stop your receiver from being jammed by your own transmitter where both are going through the exact same antenna on your handheld reader at the same time? And the answer, if the standing wave ratio of the antenna is low enough, like 1.06:1, 30 dB reflection coefficient, the signal coming back by reflection from your own antenna is so low compared to the tag response that you want to hear at minus 80 dBm that they don't get jammed. The receiver has enough dynamic range to tolerate that strong local signal. And there's a directional coupler in that line going to the antenna, which goes to the receiver. The directional coupler is only looking at the signal coming back from the antenna, where the main signal coming back from the antenna is the tag signal.
And repeater, timeout.
Boy, I'm getting good at timeouts. You can tell I'm on my favorite subject. I'm really wound up on this one. And so the directional coupler going to the antenna is listening to the signal coming back from the antenna. The primary signal that you care about is the tag signal. And the other signal coming back from the antenna is the Viswire reflection. If the antenna has got a low enough Viswire standing wave ratio, the signal coming back from the antenna is 30 dB weaker than the transmitter. And so the 1 watt transmitter plus 30 dBm and the standing wave ratio of minus 30 dB S11 on the antenna means that the signal reflecting from your antenna with 1 watt going into it is only 1 milliwatt reflected at 0 dBm. And the signal coming from the tag at maximum range is around minus 80 dBm. And so now as long as the receiver has 80 dB of dynamic range, it can listen to one versus the other. One of those signals is modulated with the tag information, the digital code, 96 bits, and the other signal is the steady state signal coming from your own transmitter, reflected from your own antenna. You can see why that system is, in my mind, a CW radar, even more sophisticated than an IFF. IFF has a different time of transmitting and different time of receiving. So transmitted signal and received signal do not jam each other. This system is operating simultaneously in the transmit and receive mode. It's a CW radar. And as sophisticated as that system is, as simple as it is, the tag itself in high production, let me drop it. That radio tag with the 96 bits of coded information, which is programmable, by the way, in some cases, is about a 20-cent expenditure. And you put that simple printed circuit tag, it's about 4 inches long and about 3/4 of an inch wide, you glue that onto a box that you put into your warehouse, and somebody has filed the box in the wrong place, and it's got perishable material in it, and you take a modern-day handheld reader, and you say, I'm looking for box number 45. It's got tag number so-and-so. So you program the reader in your hand, look for tag number so-and-so. And you walk up and down the aisles waving this thing around, and pretty soon it starts beeping at you saying, I found it. It's in that direction. It's 15 feet away from you, 45 degrees up, 15 feet away from you in this azimuth direction. And oh, by the way, that's a box, that's the third box back on the shelf that the barcode, you'd never be able to see it. We wouldn't be able to read it. But this thing is reading that tag through those other boxes, telling you where it is, and you found your lost piece of perishable equipment. Or maybe your tractor-trailer truck has just delivered 60,000 pounds of cargo, and all the cargo is on wooden pallets, and all of the cargo on the wooden pallets are in individual boxes, and a forklift is going to pick up that box out of the back of the truck, bring it through the portal of your warehouse. As it walks through the warehouse portal, there are RFID reading antennas on the left and right side of that portal that are reading the tags on the boxes that are on that pallet. And in that scenario, you can read as many as 500 tags per second as that forklift is moving at high speed through that docking door and about to deliver that stuff inside the warehouse. Can you see the value of that? Well, you now know exactly, did the material that I ordered, did it all get received? Is it all on that pallet? Is it the right time? And now you're going to break down that pallet and store that stuff in various places in the warehouse, and you've got a set of records where you think you put all that stuff, but occasionally you lose a piece of perishable material. That's just one of many applications, as you can see. Where you could also make, let me drop this. You could make a remote reading system. You can build a tag, which just sucks up the local magnetic field. And you mount that tag on your 100 kilovolt wire of your power transmission system, where that piece of wire is 150 feet in the air, and you mount the tag on that wire, and now you stand on the ground 100 feet below that thing, with the right kind of an antenna, of course, and you read that tag. The tag is being powered by the current flowing through that wire, and the tag is telling you right now the current flowing through that wire is 1,351 amperes. And you don't have to climb the 150-foot tower to measure the current. You stand on the ground, you aim your meter at that tag, and it gives you that information. Or you put that tag inside of a nuclear power station. And now you stand outside the power station, and you aim your reader through the glass door and read whatever parameter you want to that's being recorded by that tag. Local temperature, pressure, radiation, and whatever, humidity, and so on. Can you see the power of these things? And you don't have to have a battery on it. It is being powered by the radio signal you send to it. A vector network analyzer allows you to do this kind of work. Let's have that vector network analyzer question, John. KC2WGB, after waiting for some peeps, do a better job than I did. K2RIW in the TechNet. Looks like there's no peeps at this time, huh, John?
Yeah, also it's not dropping, Dick. Well, anyway, I know we have many people waiting for the whole space report. That's important. I'll save this question for next week, Dick, and it's rather lengthy, and you're going to have to go into quite a explanation on this one, I think. So we'll keep this for next week. It won't go bad. Back to you, Dick.
Good. We'll go stale. That's good. And I'm trying to remember, when I go over to Pole, I found a space report-like thing. I'm reviewing some papers this week, which I'm going to bring to Paul's attention, if I can find it while he's talking. WS2N, K2IW, go right ahead, Paul. Let's see how well I'm hearing you tonight for space report number, I think it's 143. You've got it, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. Yeah, no tones. Yeah, 144. Yeah, Dick, let me see how you're copying, and then we'll continue.
S2ZH, KC2TVG,
I'll copy. Somebody asked how copy, but we're copying you very well. Paul, you're loud and clear. WS2N with the space report, number 144. I counted wrong. K2IW, you got a Paul.
Very good. What's going to happen if I ever miss a week here? I'll get myself all fouled up, but good. Yeah, I'm looking forward to the international docking adapters to eventually get sent up to the space station. These adapters have been built by Boeing, and it won't be on this flight by SpaceX. It'll be on flight number 7, the next one, and flight number 9 will send up to docking adapters, and that really ushers in the beginning of the commercial flights that will be going up to the space station probably within a year or so. You'll be able to have a crew dock with the space station. It'll be these docking collars, international docking adapters will be put on to the pressure mating adapters that are up there. There's pressure mating adapter 2 and 3. 2 is already attached to the Harmony node. And then number 3 is presently attached to the Tranquility node, but that will be relocated also over to the Harmony node, so you'll be able to have two-man spacecraft on the American side attached. But these are docking adapters. Yeah, wires and data cables. As a tone, installed during some spacewalks, free spacewalks they had a couple weeks ago, and once these adapters get up there, they'll attach all those cables that were laid out by the astronauts. First of all, they'll actually attach the collar itself, the direct arm hookup will get the take the adapter from the Dragon spacecraft and bring it close, very, you know, within a foot of